Well, my own particular way of doing things, ladies and gentlemen, in regard to this lecture, is to start with some concrete instances, some quotations, because I have always had a feeling that the best and, in a sense, the most profound way of talking about abstract general subjects is, if possible, to do so in concrete terms, to try to find a biographical illustration of some kind which makes clear the nature of the generalized idea. So I'm going to begin with several quotations. The first of them is a quotation from Helen Keller's autobiography, which records what happened when an extremely intelligent child who was born, who lost, at a very early age, lost both her vision and her hearing, what happened when she suddenly discovered language. This is I think it's a profoundly touching and profoundly illuminating passage, this. It goes as follows. My teacher brought me my hat, and I knew we were going out into the warm sunshine. This thought, if a wordless sensation can be called a thought, made me leap and skip for joy. We walked down the path to the well house. Someone was pumping water, and my teacher placed my hand under the spout. As the cool stream gushed over my hand, she spelled into the other the word water, first slowly, then rapidly. Suddenly I felt a misty consciousness as of something forgotten, a thrill of returning thought, and somehow the mystery of language was revealed to me. I knew then that water meant the wonderful cool something that was flowing over my hand. That living word awakened my soul, gave it light, hope, joy, set it free. I left the well house eager to learn. Everything had a name, and each name gave birth to a new thought. As we returned to the house, every object which I touched seemed to quiver with life. That was because I saw everything with the strange new sight that had come to me. Well, this, I think, as I say, is a very touching and very revealing statement about the immeasurable importance of language to human beings. Well, now let us hear some quotations from the other side about the limitations of language. And the quotations I shall begin with are from some of the greatest manipulators of language in the history of literature. I shall begin with some quotations from Goethe. After all, there were few people who knew how to handle language better than Goethe did. And it's very interesting to hear what sometimes he thought about this medium in which he was such an amazing master. In one place he says, Gefühl ist alles, Name ist Schall und Rauch. And then there's the famous line out of Faust, Grau, teure Freund, ist alle Theorie, und grün des Lebens goldener Baum. Gray is all theory, green life's golden tree. And then in the conversations with Eckermann, he has a very interesting series of remarks. He says, we talk too much. We should talk less and draw more. I personally should like to renounce speech altogether and, like organic nature, communicate everything I have to say in sketches. That fig tree, this little snake, the cocoon on my windowsill, waiting quietly for its future, all these are momentous signatures. Indeed, a person able to decipher their meaning properly would soon be able to dispense with the written and the spoken word altogether. The more I think of it, there is something futile, mediocre, and even foppish about language. And another great manipulator of words, Emerson, speaks about the same problem from another point of view. He says this: consider that the perpetual admonition of nature is, the world is new, untried. Do not believe in the past. I give you the universe new and unhandled every hour. You think in idle hours that there is literature, history, science behind you, so accumulated as to exhaust thought and prescribe your own future and the future in general. In your sane hours, you shall see that nothing yet has been written, that for all the poetry there is in the world, your first sensations on entering a wood or standing on the shores of a lake has not been enchanted yet. It remains for you unwritten. This, of course, describes the essential ineffability of experience. We're accustomed, of course, in religious literature to be told that the mystical experience is ineffable, that it can't be written about. But in the final analysis, any sensuous experience is ineffable. After all, the color red, this is a purely conventional term. When I say red, you have some notion what I mean, because you have had experiences of red. But this perfectly arbitrary syllable, red, does not in any way convey the exact quality of the sensation that we have when we're looking at, say, a red rose or a scarlet poppy. This ineffability, I think, is something which all great artists in words have felt. I'm going to quote now a very beautiful passage from the Elizabethan poet Drayton, who has four lines on this. He says, they are the smallest portions of the mind that pass the narrow organ of the voice. The great remain behind in that vast void of the apprehension, in that vast orb of the apprehension, and are never born. This is, I think, a very beautiful statement of the absolute ineffability, finally, of all experience. This is something I shall have to try to talk about in the succeeding lecture, the problem of how do we communicate in symbolic form these ineffable experiences. It can be done to some extent, but it always remains, for the great artist, very frustrating that he cannot do what he wants to do simply because of the limitations of the medium. Well, then let's pass now from the arts to the more practical spheres of life. We find one of the great masters of the practical political life, Talleyrand, saying, the function of words is to conceal thought. And he undoubtedly practiced this function to an extraordinary extent. And then when we turn to another great master, malevolent master of language, it's interesting to see what Hitler has to say about the powers of language. He, of course, by means of his propaganda technique, was able to really establish control of 70 million rational people in an unbelievably effective way. And what he says about this technique is, to be effective, propaganda must confine itself to a few very simple ideas expressed in a few stereotyped formulas, constantly repeated. And this, of course, remains in the whole sphere of political propaganda, in the sphere of commercial propaganda and advertising. This is a completely true statement, which illustrates the enormous power of language. And now let us consider the religious field. What have people in the religious field said about the limitations of language? Again and again, we find in the epistles of St. Paul statements on this subject. I mean, he says, for example, the letter killeth, and the spirit giveth life. He says we should serve in the newness of the spirit and not in the oldness of the letter. And meaning that concepts, of course, notions, merely symbolic expressions of ideas, are not the thing that save one. It is only, of course, through an immediate experience that the end of religion can be consummated. And in his own quite violent and paradoxical way, Meister Eckhart says, why do you prate about God? Whatever you say about him is untrue. And we find exactly the same kind of statement in the Far Eastern Mahayana Buddhism, in Chinese Mahayana and in Japanese Zen. We find such statements as this. The Buddha never preached the enlightening truth, the liberating truth. He never preached it for the simple reason that what liberates is not the concepts which we read in the sacred books, but simply the experience of liberation. And the Zen masters go so far as to say that anybody who keeps on pronouncing the name of Buddha ought to have his mouth washed out with soap, because this is not the way to get to the final end of religion. Well, we have all these examples, and I think they are a very good introduction to a more generalized discussion of the relationship between the symbols in general, and in particular language, which is the most commonly used and the most elaborately developed of all our symbol systems. They form an extremely good introduction. On the one hand, we see that language is all important. On the other hand, we see that it has limitations and can, in a variety of ways, lead us astray. Well, let us begin by a kind of historical and psychological consideration. The words with which the fourth gospel opened, "In the beginning was the word," are profoundly true in relation, certainly, to human life. I don't think we can't say that they're true in relation to the beginning of the universe, but they are unquestionably true in relation to the beginning of humanity and human civilization. It was the invention of language by our remote ancestors which finally distinguished man from the brutes. And the fact, the ways in which human behavior differs from animal behavior are to an enormous extent conditioned by the fact that man has a conceptual language. The language of animals, of course, is merely a series of noises, emotionally conditioned noises, about events taking place here and now. They have no conceptual terms. And they can't, they have no words which indicate classes of things or the general resemblance of things. And this means that they can't think in generalities. They can't think at all successfully about the past or the future, or about events which are remote from them in space as well as in time. A very interesting example of this was provided by the great German ethologist Köhler, whose apes, he found, were perfectly capable, if a banana was hung out of their reach and a stick was set before them, they were perfectly capable of picking up the stick and knocking the banana down. But if the banana was placed in front of them and the stick was placed behind them, they couldn't do this, because they had to see both the things at once in order to be able to do this thing. We have, of course, a name banana and a name stick, and therefore we can hold these two things in our mind simultaneously, even when they are not simultaneously present to our senses. The ape, which lacks these symbolic concepts for the objects in question, cannot do this, so that we see this extraordinarily intelligent animal limited in this absurd way. I mean, it seems absolutely incredible that a creature as intelligent as a chimpanzee should be so ridiculously limited as it is through this lack of language. And of course it is precisely the existence of language which makes the enormous qualitative difference between human and animal behavior. Human behavior is to a large extent consistent and continuous. I mean, it can be. We can go on pursuing a single goal for months or years together. This is simply because we have formulated ideals, we have formulated principles, we have this pattern of language which acts as a sort of set of tracks along which we can run. The animal does not have anything of the kind, and consequently its behavior is extraordinarily intermittent. It's very curious, for example, to observe two cats fighting. They will spar up against one another and spit and scratch, and then suddenly one will stop and lift a hind leg and start licking itself, and the other will scratch and turn around. Then they will begin fighting again. This, of course, among human beings would be impossible, because each opponent would have in his head, this devil is out to kill me, he belongs to an inferior race, and I must suppress him in one way or another. We have then, this language gives us this capacity to be consistent, both for good and for evil in our behavior. I mean, in this context, we can say that language is a device for making it possible for human beings to do in cold blood what animals can do only in the heat of passion, either positive passion of affection or love, or else in the negative passions of hatred and dislike. Whereas we, because of language, can go on behaving either, as I say, in the most extremely intelligent and even angelic way, or else in an incredibly stupid and diabolic way, of which animals, both of which ways of behaving, animals are completely incapable. This, I think, is an extraordinarily important point, that we have this capacity for behaving much better and much more intelligently than animals, but also behaving much worse and much more stupidly than animals. I mean, no animal would be capable of the prolonged diabolism of people inspired by some hideous negative ideal which permits them to go on behaving abominably over years and years. Nor is any animal capable of doing the extraordinarily stupid things which our superstitions and prejudices compel us to do. With the language makes possible these two extremes of human behavior. As I say, the angelic, it is possible for a human being to be a saint. It's not possible for an animal to be a saint. It is possible for a human being to be a great scientist. It's impossible for an animal to be one. But it is also possible for a human being to be a Hitler. And it is also possible for a human being to cherish the most grotesque and hideous superstitions and to act upon them in a consistent and grotesque manner. Well, over and above this control of individual behavior, language, of course, is what gives the continuity to any society or culture. Lamarckism, biologically speaking, is untrue. The acquired characteristics are not inherited on the biological level, but they are inherited on the psychosocial level, inasmuch as each generation, thanks to language, can profit by the knowledge and experience accumulated by the previous generation and its ancestors in general, and can stand on the shoulders of its predecessors and go further, so that there, we have, so to say, invented a new and much more rapid form of evolution by evolving this extraordinary instrument of language. But again, I think we must stress the point that the language can bequeath to us from one generation to another not only valuable information and ethically useful traditions, it can also hand on monstrous superstitions, absurd prejudices, and most dreadful kind of prejudices in regard to other human beings, so that it is always ambivalent in its workings. In recent years, there has been, of course, a great stress has been laid in modern philosophical writing on the immense importance of symbols. And it's rather interesting to find that in the Oriental tradition, this goes back a long way, this conception of the enormous importance of language. In the Indian tradition, the power which creates the strictly human world, the world in which human beings live, is called Namarupa, name and form. And this name is, so to say, the subjective aspect of form, and form is the objectification of name and its projection into the outer world. And name and form together create the human world, the all-too-human world in which we live, the world of separate objects, the world of the subject-object relationship, the world of things, often quite unrelated to one another. I mean, there's this remarkable fact that we do not, our language doesn't help us by its structure to think of the world as a continuum. We have to think of it in terms of these separate objects, whereas, of course, as we tend to discover as the science progresses, the world is a continuum, and it's extremely difficult to think of the world as a continuum in terms of the ordinary language. We have to adopt various kinds of mathematical languages in order to be able to think of the world as a continuum. Now, in the mystical traditions, both of the East and the West, enlightenment or salvation or union with God may be described as a grammar-transcending state of mind, where the world is looked at not through the kind of lattice work of the local language and symbol system, but in a direct experience. I shall have more to say about this in a later lecture, but I just want to point out this, that you find this again and again arising, being stressed in the mystical literature, that we have to get beyond the conceptual level in order to arrive at what the Hindus call moksha, what the Buddhists call nirvana, and what the Christian mystics would call union with God. It is necessary to transcend this human and absolutely essential preoccupation with language. Again, here we have the same sense of the ambivalence of language, that it is absolutely necessary. We would not be human without language. But if we want to go to the limits of the religious experience, we somehow have to get beyond language. Now, let us briefly consider how minds work without language. William James spoke of immediate experience as a blooming, buzzing confusion, and he regarded language as the artificial way in which we imposed some kind of order upon the blooming, buzzing confusion. I think now the contemporary psychologist and neurologist would say that the confusion isn't quite as blooming and buzzing as James supposed, that the nervous system itself does a curious job of selection and abstraction long before language comes into play. And of course, when we look at the lower species of animals, we find the most extraordinary selection and abstraction going on in various species. I mean, actually, what any animal is aware of is not the universe as we know it. I mean, it's not aware of the sky, the sea, the wind, the trees. It is just aware of what of those particular objects which are either edible or dangerous to itself. And it lives in this exceedingly limited world. Its nervous system is so constructed that it just selects out of the infinite number of data in the world those aspects which are biologically valuable to it or biologically perilous. And some of these umwelts, as von Uexküll called them, of animals, are unutterably strange. It's been established recently, for example, that the world in which the frog lives is profoundly unlike any world of which we are aware. Its eyes are optically, apparently, very, very efficient. But it perceives only that which moves. When things stop moving, it doesn't see them. I mean, they sit on a lily pad and look down into the water, and when the minnow is moving, it sees the minnow. When the minnow stops still, the minnow disappears. And so this must be an extremely odd world, to say the least of it. The difference between our nervous system and that of even quite the higher animals below us is that although our nervous system undoubtedly selects and abstracts, it lets in a great deal more than the nervous systems of most animals. And it lets in, as I say, a great profusion of data. And a profusion which, I think here James is right, that if we did nothing about it, would certainly seem a confusion. And I think there is some evidence that certain types of mental illness are characterized by an inability on the part of the sick person's nervous system to shut out those aspects of the universe which are unnecessary to him biologically or which are of no special interest to him as a social being. I mean, apparently there are some unfortunate people in mental hospitals who are bombarded by an incredible number of stimuli of every kind, which produces, needless to say, the most frightful confusion. But even even those whose nervous systems are working well and which cut out a good deal of the external world still let in a lot. And it is here, of course, that language comes in, and that we impose an order by means of language. We abstract and categorize and pigeonhole things in their various categories, and so are able to create this order in which we do our living. Now, we not only have this, I think, this kind of inborn capacity, not merely on the neurological level, but also on the linguistic level, for abstracting and then for turning things into symbols. We also quite clearly enjoy the manipulation of symbols. I mean, we love the symbols, and we like fitting them together into extraordinarily complex patterns and systems, which give us sometimes the reality and sometimes the illusion of understanding what the world is all about. And we do this with a kind of play. It's a kind of art for art's sake. I think if we look at the symbol systems which men of various cultures have produced, we are greatly struck by the fact that many of them quite clearly have absolutely no biological value at all. They are the most elaborate kind of games which we impose, which we play, and which through whose rules we look at the world. And of course, when one examines the history and looks into what has happened in various cultures, we see that these games which we produce, these curious structures, symbolic structures which we build up for fun, may often be not merely not useful to us, but also may be positively harmful. For example, take the case of an extraordinarily intelligent people, the Greeks. In spite of their high rationality and their high development of science, they still believed that astronomy had a kind of special human meaning. And we see as a curious event in history that this belief could be absolutely disastrous. On a certain day, I think it was the 27th of August, 413 BC, there was an eclipse of the moon. Well, at this date, Nicias and the Greek army were besieging Syracuse, and they were thinking of going home because they were obviously not succeeding in their effort. But there was an eclipse of the moon, and as everybody knew, an eclipse of the moon is extremely unlucky, and no one should travel for at least a month after this. Well, Nicias decided to remain for another month, and in the course of that month, his fleet was totally destroyed, and all his army was captured and enslaved. And another disastrous example of what happens when we start playing with our symbol systems and build up these fantastic structures out of them is provided by the Aztecs. The Aztecs also had very curious views about the nature of astronomy. They thought that that the sun would get tired and die if he wasn't constantly supplied with food, and that the best food for the sun was human blood and the hearts of victims. And they used to raid their neighbors and carry off huge numbers of prisoners whom they would rip the heart out of on the altars dedicated to the sun. Well, what was the consequence of this? The consequence was that when the tiny band of Spaniards arrived, all the neighbors of the Aztecs joined the Spaniards, and Aztec regime came to an end very, very rapidly. And we find these, as I say, these extraordinary playful manipulations of system of symbols built up into all kinds of mythologies and pseudo-philosophies and pseudo-sciences at all periods in the history of the world, and sometimes they are quite harmless, merely rather absurd, but sometimes they are profoundly harmful, and yet men will go on cherishing them. Such is the, first of all, the extraordinary psychological inertia of man, that he dislikes changing even that which is obviously extremely inconvenient and harmful. And secondly, he has, of course, there's a kind of vested interest in these things, and he tends to regard them in some way as sacred. And as we see from the case of Socrates and from many of the heretics throughout the ages, that it is extremely dangerous to start questioning the validity of these symbol systems. Now, I would like here to speak briefly about the symbol systems which are rather nearer to us. Let us take the case of the Middle Ages. Why didn't the Middle Ages develop anything resembling modern science? Well, the answer to this is given by the great French historian of medieval art, Émile Malle. What he says is this: in the Middle Ages, the idea of a thing was always more real than the thing itself. The study of things for their own sake held no meaning for thoughtful men. The task for the student of nature was to discover the eternal truth which God meant each thing to express. Now, but when we inquire what was the eternal truth which was supposed to be expressed by each thing, we find, of course, that it was not the laws of nature as we speak of them. It was not the regularities which can be discovered by observation and also which require for their discovery the sacrifice of many old prejudices and even of common sense, as we're discovering now. Far from that, the eternal truths which were to be discovered in things were notions deduced by logicians from other notions and fantasies which could be found in books which were regarded as authoritative. We have, when I must confess that when I read the literature of the Middle Ages, I begin by being entertained and amused by this curious anthropomorphic view of the world. But in a very little while, I find myself not merely profoundly bored, but also feeling a sense of terrible oppression. One seems to be shut into a kind of prison. There are no windows in this medieval world. Everything in Gerald Manley Hopkins's words, shares man's smudge and shares man's smell. There is this terrible, sort of all too human quality about the world. Yes, it wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. This I do find extremely depressing in the whole medieval world picture. But it was impossible for human beings, given their symbol system, which they accepted without question, most of them, to get outside this prison. And in a much more recent case, we have a very interesting example of the impossibility of getting beyond a going symbol system. We have a very good example of this in the history of hypnosis, which is a subject I happen to be very much interested in. If you look at the history of hypnosis in the first half of the 19th century, you are astonished to find that extremely intelligent men refused to believe the evidence of their senses. They saw these hypnotic phenomena. I mean, for example, eminent doctors would see a hypnotic operation being carried out, an amputation being carried out under hypnotic anesthesia, and would say that it wasn't true. I mean, they would say that the man was obviously shamming, just pretending he didn't feel pain in order to annoy the doctors, or that in some way the operator was bamboozling them. I mean, it is absolutely incredible when you read the history of this, and also to read the way in which great pioneers in this field who demonstrated, for example, that they could reduce the mortality rate from surgery, which was then 29%, to 5% by using hypnotic anesthesia, men like Esdale, were simply hounded out of the medical profession for what they did instead of being greeted as saviors of society. Not at all. They were attacked because it was impossible for their orthodox colleagues to get outside the prison of the symbol system in which they had been brought up. And much more recently, there's William James, of course, had the same complaint about his colleagues in regard to a subject in which he was deeply interested, what is now called extrasensory perception. And he says again and again that the evidence, which was considerable then, and which I think is still more considerable now, was simply disregarded because it did not make sense in terms of the Weltanschauung, the symbol system, which was then fashionable. And rather than extend the system so as to embrace the new facts were rejected in order to retain the system. And in this context, I would like to quote a remark which my grandfather, Thomas Henry Huxley, made about Herbert Spencer. He said that Herbert Spencer's idea of a tragedy was a deduction foully murdered by a fact. And now, it's quite obvious that our present symbol systems are a good deal wider and more comprehensive than those, say, which were current in the Middle Ages. But I think undoubtedly historians of the future will look back and note with astonishment the way in which our attachment to our present kind of symbolic picture of the world has blinded us to facts which to them will be completely self-evident. I mean, I don't know what these facts are, but I think we can say without any doubt that 100 or 200 years from now, people will look back and think, well, isn't it incredible that in the middle of the 20th century, when such and such facts were so obvious, staring people in the face, that their attachment to their particular Weltanschauung, their particular symbol system, was so strong that they could not envisage these facts. They could not take them in and incorporate them into the general picture of knowledge. Well, the moral of all this seems to me clear, that we somehow, that we have to make the best of both worlds, to make the best of the world of immediate experience, which I haven't been able to discuss at any length today, but which I hope to discuss in a later lecture, the world which we receive in a state of receptivity. Needless to say, no experience is absolutely immediate, because all our experiences are to some extent conditioned by the cultural milieu in which we've grown up, by the symbol system which is imposed upon us by our language. But there are degrees of immediacy. I mean, we can be much more immediate or much less immediate in the way we experience the external world. And as I say, the problem which seems to me to confront us both collectively and individually is how to make the best of these two worlds, to make the best of this fresh world, the world which the newness of the spirit, as St. Paul says, or the life's golden tree, as Goethe says, to make the best of this world of pure receptivity, and also to make the best of the symbolic and above all the linguistic world. And our business is first of all, I think, to find methods for training ourselves in being more aware of internal and external data, and also means for continually refining and improving the symbol system which we use in order to impose sense and meaning upon the world. After all, one of the great intellectual developments of the 20th century has been a development in the field of linguistics. We do know much more about the nature of language and about its limitations and its capacities than was known in the past. And I think it is very important that this knowledge should go down right into the roots of education. I mean, that it's possible to teach some of this knowledge to quite small children and to develop the teaching as the young people grow up, so as to make them more aware of the relationship between the symbolic world in which they have to do their thinking and the world of immediate experience in which they do their most of their aesthetic and their spiritual and physiological living. So that, I mean, in fine, we just have to stress once more this fact, which I have spoken about several times, that we are amphibians, and that it is our business to get on, as get the maximum out of all the universes to which, owing to our strange amphibious nature, we have access. And this is something I shall go on in developing in the later lectures. So, as I say, we are multiple amphibians. We are not merely amphibians in relation to immediate experience and to symbols, but we are amphibians in other respects too. And as I say, the final moral, as far as I can see, is that we must somehow learn to make the best of all the worlds in which our extraordinarily complex nature predestines us to live. Thank you.